Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced, from the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support. The new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.
Two white men that I never seen before there in my life, and they didn't have a gun where I could see it. And so I had no idea. I thought perhaps maybe they was lost. And I cut the lawnmower off and I said, "Can I help you?" And they said, "Yes, we're looking for Anthony Reagan." And I said, "That would be me. Again, how can I help you?" And they said, "Well, we are two detectives and we have a warrant for your arrest." And I said, "For what? Do you own a pistol?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Do your mother own a pistol?" And I said, "Yes." "I'm going to make sure you found ketchup." I said, "For a crime I didn't commit, there's five things that are going to convict you. Would you like to know what they are?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Number one, you black. Number two, a white man is going to say you shot him. Whether you shot him or not, I don't care." Then he said, "Number three, you're going to have a white prosecutor. Number four, you're going to have a white judge. And number five, more likely you're going to have an all-white jury." And he said, "Do you know what that spells? Conviction, 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 conviction." The prosecution said, "On my day of conviction, we didn't get the right nigger today, but at least we got a nigger off the street."
After more than 30 years on Alabama's death row for a crime he did not commit, Anthony Ray Hinton walked away from prison a free man. Family, friends, and supporters waited outside the prison gates. With a smile, he said, "The sun does shine." Those four words became the title of his new book that chronicles his wrongful conviction, 34 years on death row, and his battle for freedom. Today, I talked to Hinton about his new book and his experiences with the Alabama justice system.
Well, I just finished your book, and I loved it. I thought it was just absolutely well done, and I thought it was an extremely empathetic and caring book. I was just really impressed with it. I just can't say enough about how much I enjoyed the book. And
thank you so much. Thank you so much. To relive the painful memory. But I felt that the book needed to be written. And I wrote the book trying to show people about justice, love, and that all of us can reach down deep and do better. So my particular thing was about Henry Francis Hayes. And I wanted society to realize that hate is something you taught. You're not born with it. And so just as you teach hate, it may take a lot of undoing, but you can teach and show people love, and hopefully you can undo that hateful that they have been learned by whoever taught it to them.
Why don't we start at the beginning with your life? You grew up in Alabama. Tell me about that.
Well, I grew up in Alabama in a coal mining town called Praco, P-R-A-C-O. And right away, blacks live up on top of the hill and the white people live in the bottom. And we had our own little school at one particular time, and it's about, I guess, maybe 5 miles from where we lived, and we had to walk to school and walk back from school, and it wasn't safe in the sense of white people would come by and hit on the doors, and some would even try to run off and catch you, and we were very careful. It was just a time of growing up, knowing what racism was, and we jumped in the ditches a lot of time and hid a lot of time coming from school as well. And Franco, though, was a happy place, regardless of what we endured going in to and from school. But once we was able to reach home, there was not a better, safe place to live than Franco. We all played together. We all went to school together, church together. We ate at each other's homes. Every mother was our mother, and every father was our father. And it was a neighborhood. When I tell you, it was a village, and as we say, it takes a village to raise a child, I can truthfully say that I lived in a village where all of the adults treated you as if they was your own mother and father. And so, well, we come up in one area I would call the best life one could have, and it wasn't until we went to walk to school and had to get outside our neighborhood that we felt a little threatened. And so we didn't have much, but what we had more than anything, all our parents, but mine in particular, loved me unconditionally. And I loved to play. I loved sports. And my mom encouraged me and got behind me to no matter what I wanted to do in life, she was my biggest cheerleader. And we was grew up in a place, now everybody talking about Walmart, but Walmart existed back in the early 50s in Preco, because the commissary is what we would call it. The coal mine owned this commissary. And as long as your father worked in the mine, you could go there and get groceries, furniture, toys, whatever. The only thing they didn't sell in there was medicine. But as long as you work in the coal mine, you could charge whatever you needed to the commissary. And so our life for me was, you know, growing up and typical young boy that loved the outdoors, loved to hunt, loved to fish. And so it was just never thought about anything other than getting up every morning, playing and playing with my neighbors and seeing what we could get into. And then as you got older, girls start coming in your mind, and you start falling in love, and you start liking this one more than you do anyone else. And so just like I say, typical teenager coming up.
Tell me about, what are the origins of that love? I mean, is it a religious belief? Is it just something nurtured in your family? How would you describe it?
It was something that was nurturing out my family. My mom was a big really believer in God. My mom passed that on down to every one of her children. And again, when I talk with Preco in the neighborhood, everybody had to go to church. We didn't have a choice. And when you, at the age of four, being taught and made to go to a church, everything then, as you get older, that's what you used to. And as we got older, we still went to church. We still believed in God. And we have adopted this same faith that my mom had, and teaching us that God can do everything but fail. All you have to do is believe in him and trust in him, and he will direct your path. And so we never did question that. We never did question our parents. We never felt that they would lie to us. And I would have to say that my mom used to tell us that, you know, we may not have nothing in this world, but what we do have is a God that loves us, and a God that would protect us, and a God that would provide for us. But all we have to do is trust in him. And like any kid, you're curious, and who is this God, and where does this God live? And so we went to Sunday school, and we began to learn how God existed and how it came about. And you just develop a faith. I couldn't live on my mother's faith. I had to learn to have my own faith. And never did I ever need it more.
In 1985, two Birmingham-area fast food restaurants were robbed, and the managers John Davidson and Thomas Wayne Vassen were fatally shot. There were no eyewitnesses or fingerprint evidence. Police had no suspects, and the pressure to solve the murder grew as similar crimes continued. On July 25, 1985, a restaurant in Bessemer, Alabama, was robbed, and the manager was shot but not seriously wounded. Anthony Hinton was arrested after the manager identified him from a photo lineup, even though he was working in a locked warehouse 15 miles away at the time of the crime.
Well, I was 29 when I got arrested for and, you know, I woke up that morning, hot day in July. And when I say hot, I mean hot. And so never do you wake up and say, well, I'm going to jail today. I'm going to prison today. But that day I woke up, like any other days I had woke up and was out and came inside to get some lemonade and went outside and came back in, put my glass in the sink, and my mom asked me, was I going to revival? And I said, yes. And she said, well, what time it start? And I said, 7 o'clock, Mama. And she said, well, you got time to go out there and cut that grass. And I said, you know, Mama, I promise you I'll cut that grass tomorrow. And my mom looked at me and she said, I'm trying my best to see how did you get you'll cut the grass tomorrow out of me telling you to go cut the grass. And she gave me that look only she could give me, and I knew exactly I need to get on out here and cut this grass. And I went out there and cranked up the lawnmower, and about 25 minutes into cutting the grass, I look up and there stood two white gentlemen. Two white men that I never seen before there in my life, and they didn't have a gun where I could see it. And so I had no idea. I thought perhaps maybe they was lost. And I cut the lawnmower off and I said, can I help you? And they said, yes, we're looking for Anthony Ray Hinton. I said, that would be me. Again, how can I help you? And they said, well, we are two detectives and we have a warrant for your arrest. And I said, for what? And they said, we'll explain that to you later, but right now we want you to put your hands behind your back. And I complied and I put my hands behind my back. They put the handcuffs on me. Still hadn't told me what I was being arrested for, and began to put me in the police car. And I said, hold up. At least allow me the opportunity to go in and tell my mother that I'm being arrested for something. And one of the detectives said, we can't let you go back inside. And we argued for about 2 minutes. And finally, the other detective said, let him go in and tell his mother. And so I go in and I show my mom the handcuff. And like any good mother, she just began to scream and holler. What are those handcuffs doing on my baby? And the detectives said, take him out while I stay here and talk to his mother. A few minutes later, he came out. We proceeded to go to the jail. And on the way there, I asked him, why am I being arrested? And he finally turned around. He looked at me and he said, do you own a pistol? And I said, no. And he said, do your mother own a pistol? And I said, yes. And I told him what kind. They dropped me off at a substation in a little place called Door, Alabama. They went back to my mom's house and must have told me that I told him about a pistol. She went, got the pistol, gave it to him, let him look at it. She told me, they said it wasn't nothing on the pistol but dust, and the pistol hadn't been fired for about 20, 25 years. And so I guess they asked her, could they keep it in there, bring it back, and she told them yes. So they had the pistol pick me up. We proceeded to Birmingham again, and I said, Detective, why am I being arrested? And finally, he said, we charging you with first-degree robbery, first-degree kidnap, and first-degree attempted murder. And I said, I haven't done any of that. And the detective said, listen, I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it. I'm going to make sure you found guilty of it. I said, for a crime I didn't commit? He said, you must have a hearing problem. Didn't I tell you I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it? He said, but you remember this if you remember nothing. I'm going to make sure you found guilty of it. And as we drove just a little far, he turned around and he said, and by the way, there's 5 things that are going to convict you. Would you like to know what they are? And I said, yes. He said, number one, you black. Number two, a white man is going to say you shot him. Whether you shot him or not, I don't care. Believe me, I don't care. Then he said, number three, you're going to have a white prosecutor. Number four, you're going to have a white judge. And number five, more than likely you're going to have an all-white jury. And he said, do you know what that spells? And he repeated the word conviction, 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 conviction. And once we got to the county jail, he finally told me, sit me in this room, and I sit there for about 2.5 hours. And he came back, and I said, Detective, what date and what time did this crime take place? He goes through his note, and he looks, and he tells me the date and the time. And to be honest with you, I said, thank you, God, thank God. I said, I was at work that particular day. And at that particular time, I said, thank you, Jesus. I said, my supervisor happened to be white. And I'm thinking that once you go there and he tell you that I was at work and he show you my time card or whatever, everything would be all right. And they goes to where I was working at and they come back and he say, I got good news and bad news. And the good news is we no longer going to charge you for first-degree robbery, first-degree kidnap, and first-degree attempted murder. So your alibi checks out. But we have decided now that we're going to charge you with 2 counts of capital murder. I said, capital murder? But I haven't killed anybody. The detective said, you really got to do something about that kid problem because I told you on the way here, I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it. He said, the same thing goes for these 2 cases. I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it, but I'm going to make sure you found guilty of it. And we talked a little bit. And the detective looked at me and he said, let me tell you something. He said, I truly believe you can do it. He said, but y'all is always taking up for one another. Take this rap for your homeboy. And with tears coming down my eyes, I looked at this detective and I tell this detective, there's not a homeboy in this world that I would take this rap for. And I go to trial. The judge asked me, do I understand my rights? And I tell him, yeah. He asked me, can I afford an attorney? And I tell him, no. He looks back in his courtroom and he called one up front without even asking me my name. The first thing this attorney said, I did not go to law school to do pro bono work. I looked at this lawyer and I said, would it make a difference to you if I told you that I was innocent? That same lawyer looked at me and he said, the problem with that statement, all of y'all is always doing something and then saying you didn't do it. And then he said something more profound. He said, I'm only going to get $1,000 to represent you. He said, I eat $1,000 for breakfast. And he carried me away, and I sit in jail for 1.5 years. And out of that 1.5 years, I seen this lawyer perhaps twice. I didn't know his strategy. I didn't know what he was going to do. But we went to trial, and they found me guilty on 2 counts. Of first-degree capital murder. That day, the judge proudly stood up and said, Anthony Ray Hinton, you have been found guilty of 2 counts of first-degree capital murder. He said, it is the order of this court that I sentence you to death. And then that judge had the audacity to say, may God have mercy on your soul. And the prosecution that day went out and told the media that the state of Alabama got the worst killer that ever walked the street, off the street. But it wasn't true. And on December 17, 1986, I went to Holman Correction Facility, where I would remain there for 30 long years.
Dangerous prison, isn't it?
That is the worst prison in the state of Alabama, and some have deemed it as the worst prison in the country. And so death row inmates is where they house death row inmates there. And so that's where they sent me, and that's where I had to go. And I lived in this 5x7 cell for 30 years. What hurt me, and I know you're going to ask whatever you want, is the fact that they knew that that gun didn't match. They knew that I was not the person that they looked for. What most people don't know, I wasn't on their radar. It wasn't like I ever been convicted of robbery or violent crime. I had some theft of property. I stole a car, and I wrote a bad check. That's it. But they arrested me because I was light-skinned and black. They didn't have nothing else stained, nothing. There was no fingerprints. There was no eyewitness. There was nobody saying, that's the man that I saw running away from the restaurant that night. Nobody. A friend of mine that I played baseball with said he overheard them say they were looking for a light-skinned black male. And he told them he knew a light-skinned black male. And they said, who is it? What's his name? And he said he told them Anthony Ray Hinton. And that's what they came and charged me for being light-skinned and a black male. This is the case that the world needs to know that this, to this day, 3 years later, I would love to know what did they go to the judge and say, Your Honor, we need an arrest warrant. What did they tell him to convince him that he would get an arrest warrant? Because there was nothing about a gun. They didn't know anything about a gun. They had no fingerprints, so they had no one to say I saw it. I'm trying to figure out how in the world and what did you tell the judge that he would give you a warrant for my arrest? What did you tell him? We believe, we know who did it, and we need an arrest warrant. Did they lie to the judge and say, Your Honor, we know who did it and we need a warrant to go and arrest him? What was it? You know, I can only ask myself these questions, but I have yet to hear any reporter say, what did they arrest him about? How did his name come about? How does one go to a judge and fabricate evidence and fabricate, we know who did it. We need a search warrant. We need a warrant. I mean, I just want somebody to say, how did they arrest him? And on what charges did they get a warrant for? Because to this day, I don't know what they told the judge. You can't get a warrant to arrest somebody because they like skin and black. If that's the case, we're all in trouble.
Well, tell me about the gun. I mean, because this seems to be the perplexing thing is they had this gun that belonged to your mother that you say hasn't been used for like 25 years and it's covered with dust.
Yes.
And they had experts say that this was connected to some murders that had happened there in Birmingham.
Folks, I'm not exactly a fashion maven. While I'm talking to you right now, I'm wearing a pair of cargo shorts and a polo shirt. And until recently, I've worn the same style of eyeglasses for at least 12 years. Think about that, folks. Back when George W. Bush was president, I was wearing the same style of eyeglasses. It's not that I don't want to change. It's just that I feel kind of, well, unqualified about making a decision on eyeglasses. I mean, the lens is fine. I mean, the frames kind of intimidate me because, you know, I don't know a whole lot about fashion and I don't know a lot about design. And that's why I'm so excited about this new company called Warby Parker, because they have a computer program that helps select the appropriate eyeglasses for you. And then they cut out the middleman and they sell directly to customers online and in their stores. Warby Parker is able to provide high quality, great looking eyewear at a fraction of the usual price. Their prescription glasses start at $95. You heard me right, folks. $95 for a pair of eyeglasses? That's one-fifth the cost of glasses that I buy locally. It's unreal. I can't recommend them highly enough. And that $95, it includes the frames, the lenses, and the coatings. The people behind Warby Parker feel that glasses should not cost more than your iPhone. But guess what? They also help people in need. When you buy a pair from Warby Parker, they provide a pair to a needy person at no cost. You might be thinking, how can you possibly buy eyeglasses online? Well, with Warby Parker's completely free home try-on program, you can. Order 5 pairs of glasses online and have them shipped directly to your home or office. Then you have 5 days to try them on and show them to your friends and family for an honest opinion on what looks best. It's 100% free and really easy. When you find a pair of glasses you like, go to warbyparker.com/suspect and order your favorite pair. They'll even call your doctor if you don't have your prescription handy. And get this, this is so cool. If you have an iPhone 10, make sure to download Warby Parker's app where you can use the brand new feature, Find Your Fit. Find Your Fit uses iPhone 10's True Depth camera to map and measure your key facial features. Using these measurements, Find Your Fit recommends approximately 12 Warby Parker frames that are likely to fit your face. This process is seamless and only takes a few seconds. That is such a cool idea. And after you've headed to warbyparker.com/suspect and place your home try-on order, make sure to download the Warby Parker app for the iTunes App Store. They built this awesome home try-on companion feature, which allows you to quickly take photos wearing all of the frames, stitch it into a video, and then share it with friends and family to help you pick a winner. And once again, folks, if you're interested in this program where you can try 5 different pairs of lenses or pairs of glasses on, go to warbyparker.com/suspect and they'll ship them to you free and you can ship them back to them at no cost. It's an absolutely awesome business. I can't recommend it enough. Again, warbyparker.com/suspect. Anthony Ray Hinton was appointed a lawyer who mistakenly thought he could not get enough money to hire a qualified firearms examiner. Instead, he retained a visually impaired civil engineer with no expertise in firearms identification who admitted he could not operate the machinery necessary to examine the evidence. With no credible expert to challenge the state's assertion of a match, Mr. Hinton was convicted and sentenced to death.
Yes, I told him about the gun. It was an old 38 Smith & Wesson, and they expert examined the gun and did all the testing, and they expert said that the gun matched the bullets that they had retrieved out of the victim body. But I want you to remember something. One of the expert, ballistic expert, had wrote and told them that the gun didn't match. They then turned around and told him he needed to look again. And he changed his mind to the gun match. And they kept that. We went to trial and they kept what they call ballistic reports, where they did the examination. And all their reports, where they tested for grooves and lens, and guess what they had on their reports? Nothing but question marks. Question mark. Question mark means I don't know what this is. And when Brian Stevenson came along or something in 2005, that's when we discovered that they had these ballistic tests and reports that they never turned over, and it was full of question marks. And Brian Stevenson went out and hired three other world-renowned known experts, where my trial lawyer hired a one-eyed blind civil engineer to be my expert witness. And when I tell you, when they put him on the stand, they crucified him. When I tell you they crucified him, they crucified him. And I'm going to be honest with you. Had I been a member of the jury and we're talking about experts, you believe one over the other, I would have believed the state expert. Yeah, over it. I would have believed the same one. And the thing about that was the expert that I had was blind in one eye, and he couldn't even see how to turn on the machine. And
so why on earth did your attorney hire this blind man to be your expert who didn't even have any training in ballistics?
Well, I can only tell you because he didn't care enough to represent me. I can only tell you that he didn't know that he could get the money to hire a qualified expert. And to be perfectly honest with you, I mean, this ain't something I'm just trying to make up. The lawyer I had was even racier than the prosecution. And so he didn't care nothing about defending me to the best of his ability, nor defending me to the best of my ability. He went out and practically hired the first person that he could find. And it cost me 30 years of my life. But more important, isn't justice about getting the right person? They knew that that gun was not the gun. Make no mistake about it. They knew 30 years ago, this gun is not the gun. It don't match. One of their own expert he didn't testify, but he had already determined when he got through, it don't match. And they told him, you better go back and check it again because it do match. And he changed it. He changed it. And then I go to trial with my expert, and the prosecution spit him up and chewed him out. Did you had to ask for help just to turn on the machine? Yes. When you went, did you bring a pair of plows? Yes. Are you the modern day Charleston? And I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, not a Charleston. Well, you brought the plow. You will say anything for $50. And it did. He said anything because he didn't know. He asked him, when you turn it on, and you're looking for the bullets, what did you see? And he said, all I could see was my finger. And remember back in the 80s, they had those two where you had to look down in the microscope with two eyes. Mm-hmm. Line it up, and he couldn't do it. And he said, did you get frustrated? What did you say? And the expert, my expert said, I said, all I can see is my damn finger. I can't see nothing else. And then what shot him in the prosecution asked him, how many eyes do you have? Do you have a problem with your eyesight? And he said, why, yes. I'm blind in one eye. And this is the man that they gave me for a qualified expert. No qualification. And then you find out he was a civil engineer. He would do go around and testify, and whether he get paid or not, he still testify. And I can appreciate him wanting to help. But I can't appreciate my attorney going out not getting a qualified expert.
After spending decades on Alabama's death row, Anthony Ray Hinton reached out to the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. The initiative is run by attorney Brian Stevenson, who has advocated for those on death row.
Fast forward, Brian Stevenson got on my case in 2005, and I told Brian Stevenson that I needed a qualified ballistic expert And I told Brian Stevenson, I need a white man. And I needed this white man to be from the South. And I needed this white man to believe in the death penalty. I needed this white man to be the best of the best. But more important, I needed this white man just to tell the truth. And Brian Stevenson wanted to know, why do we have to be white? And I said, Brian, I lived in the South all of my life. And they only gonna recognize one of their own. I don't care how great a white female can be, she's no good on that stand. And Brian, you know it can't be a person of color. Because in the South, all that white prosecutor that had to do to ask this white woman one simple question. You feel somewhat sympathetic toward Mr. Hinton, don't you? And if that expert had said yes, being a white female, she would have ruined her credibility. And the prosecution would have said, ladies and gentlemen, she said what she said because you heard her say she feels somewhat sympathetic for it. And I told Mr. Stevenson, and I tell people, I hate to give you a history lesson, but that's the way they do in the South. If a white man don't say it, if a white man is not from the South, then you're in trouble. So Brian went out and got...
Why don't you explain to our listeners who Brian Stevenson is?
Brian Stevenson is God's greatest attorney. Brian Stevenson worked and started EJI, Equal Justice Initiative. Brian Stevenson believed that all of us is broken. Brian Stevenson would go and help defend and death row inmates that don't have an attorney file their appeal. Brian Stevenson also have won cases where the juveniles have been put in adult prison and been over sentenced. Brian Stevenson is, if you ever in trouble, it's the man you need, because this is the man that worked for 16 long years to get my case and to win my freedom. And 16 long years being a non-profit organization, I can't tell you how many hours that they spent trying to prove my innocence. I can't tell you the money that they spent trying to prove my innocence. But I can tell you that Brian Stevenson, along with the Equal Justice Initiative, these people, if it wasn't for them, me and you wouldn't have this interview. First, Brian Stevenson read my transcript. Brian Stevenson seen that there was a problem from the start. And then Brian Stevenson and his team began to work on my case. And what should have been the most easy case for Brian Stevenson to win turned out to be the hardest case for Brian Stevenson to win. 16 years the state of Alabama fought him. In 16 years the state of Alabama judges would rule against Mr. Stevenson and myself every year. 16 long years. And Brian Stevenson finally went out and got these experts as of, and then guess what? Three attorneys general refused to re-examine the bullets. Now, for your listeners, did the state of Alabama refuse to re-examine the bullets because they didn't have to? Or is it because they already knew that the bullets didn't match? Today, I tell you they already knew. And they knew that those bullets didn't match 30 years ago and they wasn't going to match 30 years later. But since the state of Alabama judges refused to do the right thing, Brian Stevenson filed my case to the United States Supreme Court. 2 years after filing it to the United States Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court done something that it have never done in the history of the courts. All nine justices ruled that I was entitled to a new trial. And it wasn't until then that the state of Alabama tried to tell the judge that they had lost the gun. And they didn't just say we lost the gun, Your Honor. They said Brian Stevenson stole the gun and they never did bring the gun back. And Bryan Stevenson produced paper that the Attorney General, and they had turned the gun back in. And then the judge gave them time to find the gun. They found the gun only to come to court and tell the judge they found the gun, but they had lost the bullets in question. And then she gave them more time to find the bullets. And while we were thinking they were looking for the bullets, the prosecution had called one of his old experts and told him to come and reexamine the bullets one last time. And when he came in, he was quoted as saying the bullets don't match the way they did 30 years ago. But I promise you and your listeners that they matched exactly the same as they did 30 years ago. See, the state of Alabama had every intention of executing me for a crime they knew that I didn't commit. But the state of Alabama ran into two problems that they didn't foresee. The state of Alabama didn't know that I had a personal relationship with God. And the state of Alabama didn't know that God was going to send me his best lawyer, Bryan Stevenson. And when the state of Alabama seen that Bryan Stevenson was going to challenge them on every phone, every court, it wasn't until then that the state of Alabama notified the judge and said they were dropping all charges against me. But those three attorney generals, one was by the name of Brill Pryor, who was quoted as saying it only would take an hour, but it would be a waste of the taxpayer money, and it would be a waste of my time. And for not doing his job, George W. Bush appointed him to a federal lifetime appointment. He left, and then a man by the name of Troy King took over, and he too refused to take 1 hour to reexamine the bullets. He lost in the next election, and then here comes Luther Strange. Luther Strange refused to reexamine the bullets as well, and but not doing his job, he took over the Senate seat for Jeff Sessions. Three different attorney generals. And then my life was not worth 1 hour for them to reexamine the bullets. And what I want your listeners to understand, did the bullets match or not match? It shouldn't took 30 years to determine that. But the state of Alabama already knew, and that's why the state of Alabama was willing to roll the dice. And the state of Alabama kept hoping that every court would turn me down. Every state court in Alabama had turned me down. It was only when we filed my case to the United States Supreme Court that the state of Alabama had to finally admit the truth. And to this day, the state of Alabama haven't had the decency or the backbone to say, Mr. Hinton, we're sorry. 30 years I'm sitting at hell on a 5x7 because my life was not worth them telling the truth. I can't tell you where I got this from, but I was told that the prosecution said on my day of conviction, we didn't get the right nigger today, but at least we got a nigger off the street.
Anthony Ray Hinton said one lesson he learned on death row is to focus on what's important in life.
I wish I could tell people, listen, if I had any advice to give people, I would tell people, let it go. What do you have to be racist on? Because at the end of this journey, everything that man has will be left here. And so instead of us learning to love and treat one another with respect, we hold on to something that we've been taught. Let's start teaching each other something different than race. Let's start teaching each other love, because if we don't start loving each other, this country is going to explode. Thank you.